Welcome. We would like to continue with the panel entitled Development Policies, Asymmetrical Trade Relations, and Global Financial Systems. I'm very honored that I've been invited to chair this panel. I think it's a wonderful and really important conference. And I'm also happy to have assembled here vast expertise and experience, not only in international economic law. You can't hear me? No? But is it my fault? Should I speak louder? Okay. International economic law, international development finance, legal theory, ethnography of law, human rights law. So I think we will have a fruitful discussion. Just the briefest of introductions, and I might add some further biographical information later. So on the left, Celine Chan. She's an associate professor of law at Warwick University in Great Britain. Next to her is sitting Obiora Chinedu Okafor, who is teaching law, who is professor of law at Osgoode Hall Law School in Toronto, Canada. And to my right is Luis Eslava, who is senior lecturer at Kent Law School in Great Britain. So what I would like to do, what the plan is for this panel and for the next 1.5 hours, I would like to have a conversation on broadly four themes. One, the first is post and neocolonial qualities of today's international economic law, or maybe also more broadly international law. The second theme shall be utopian aspirations of the past and the present. The third, how to teach post-colonial international economic law. And the fourth theme, if we have time, should be on critical lawyers' engagements in resistance and reform. So we will be reconnecting to themes which have come up earlier today. So let's get started with the first theme, the diagnosis of the present of the imperial qualities of international economic law. And before I give the word to our panelists, I would like to start with a very brief observation on international economic law and its scholarship. So for a long time, international economic law has been a bit of an area for specialists, not at the center of attention of mainstream international lawyers. This has changed significantly in recent times, not least due to large-scale protests, 1999 at Seattle, and these days against the multi-regionals CETA or TTIP that the EU is negotiating. So when today international economic lawyers like myself take a critical approach to international economic law, what we sometimes do is we tell a story of deterioration. And this story commonly then starts with a post-World War II economic order, the model of embedded liberalism, which was created in order to coordinate national economies through international law, while at the same time leaving states enough policy space to pursue, for example, policies of full employment, social redistribution. But of course, what is missing in this narrative, we start there and then we say the neoliberal economic order is taking over, policy space is being reduced, space for political self-determination, and politics is being colonized by economics. And what is missing in this story, obviously, is a post-colonial viewpoint. With a common story of the model of embedded liberalism being replaced by a neoliberal economic order and of politics being colonized by economics, we neglect that embedded liberalism was not a reality for the larger part of the world. Telling the story this way runs the danger of missing that post-war international economic law did not emerge out of the blue and not in reaction to trade wars of the interwar period, but that it has a much longer colonial history. So I'd like to invite us to now explore international economic law's colonial present. What are the imperial features of the current international economic law? Which continuities exist with colonization? And how have imperial relations of exploitation been reconstituted, possibly in different legal forms? So I would like to start with you, Céline. You write and teach and act as an expert also in international economic law. You have a particular specialization in the law of development finance and also in international investment law. And in one of your articles you write, and I'd like to quote, "The process of decolonization saw the rapid entry of previously peripheral countries into the global economic system, necessitating the reorganization of international economic law and governance to accommodate new post-colonial international relations, including, and now this is important, the maintenance of political influence and access by former imperial countries to resources and markets in the newly independent states." So I would like to ask now, what is the contribution of international economic law in maintaining the influence of the former imperial powers and in securing their access to markets and natural resources?
Hi, thank you very much, Isabel. And again, thank you to all the organizers for organizing this workshop and conference. I want to return to this notion of the Eurocentricism of international law, which I, like Isabel mentioned in the quote from my article, I look at it from the lens of international economic law and how that sort of the creation of law, as Tony Anghi, who, by the way, shaped a lot of my thoughts on and my work, so I owe an incredible intellectual debt to him. In terms of the creation of international law in the image of the European image and of what is a civilized nation, and in this sense, what is a civilized international economic order. And I think that's very important when we look at how international law, economic law particularly, has developed or not developed over the years. And using this, I want to bring in something that probably Lewis would be familiar with, you know, like the social legal scholars. So we have the TWAIL scholars who are also challenging, you know, the doctrinal perspective in international law. But there's also some of us kind of straddle that the TWAIL, but also the social legal tradition, which looks at law not only in terms of the rules and the books, but also what the law means in terms of a signifier. So law as regulation, but also as legitimation. So law in itself presents symbols and that signifiers of how we will construct, how we understand the nature of the world to be. And I think that international economic law has a function in that. So it creates the legal infrastructure. And I think Tony mentioned some of that, you know, the conceptions of property, who owns property, what is property rights as conceptualized as something that the law protects. So it will protect individual property rights rather than indigenous community rights. Intellectual property rights are framed in a particular way to grant, you know, certain entities rights, but not other communities. So there's that kind of reproduction of an order that is dominant, and it's very Eurocentric. But it's not just the law. I think this a lot of these things are reinforced by mythologies of law, as it were, as Peter Fitzpatrick would say it. It's how law conceptualize these terms, as in it's an absolute, and we all internalize that. I mean, you know, you all see these adverts about it's really bad to copy stuff off the photocopier, and it's really bad to, you know, like print you know, stuff without authorization. But then there is not the similar sort of advertisements of when multinational drug companies, for example, would appropriate the knowledge of indigenous peoples, develop a drug out of it, and then sell it for a profit. And that is absolutely fine because it's, you know, research development, and that is their intellectual property, not the property of the people who have, you know, for example, developed that over the years. Or, for example, when you develop and this happened during the case of the bird flu, where you develop a vaccine for a particular medicine, which you take from an exercise of, you take it from the blood and you know, from, of the people in the South who have been part of these epidemics, and that's collected from these people, and that is being used in a repository to then fund private research into vaccinations, which then are developed into vaccines, which is then sold back to the South at very highly inflated prices, but actually using the information from people and communities in the South to fund that development, that profit, but not acknowledging what their contributions to it. So law, in a way, that's law. In it's intellectual property rights, it's interactive, it's law, but it is also how it shapes our understanding. So we think, that's okay. You know, that's not a breach of intellectual property. But if you, you know, illegally copy a Hollywood movie, that's a breach of intellectual property. And that's, I think, you know, the problem in the way that international law continues to be used, I think, in a sense that reproduces the Eurocentricism of the colonial past.
But maybe just a follow-up question. So if you should pinpoint those institutions or rules of international economic law which are most responsible for perpetuating or maybe even deepening global inequality, what would those be? So you mentioned international property, intellectual property law as one of those bad regimes of international economic law.
Well, I don't, I think, you know, going back to what Tony and I was saying earlier, I mean, it's not about just the you know, international law in itself, I mean, it's problematic, but international economic law is a fairly new conception, right? I mean, in the history of international law. I think what has happened over the years, like for the law of foreign investment, for example, has developed into a very, very constraining field of international economic law. And that, in a way, guarantees access of foreign investment to developing countries. It also allows the protection of foreign investment when they are in developing countries. So there's two aspects to that. It's access to, so the liberalization aspect, and what we call non-discrimination, which, you know, basically protects the rights of, you know, the foreign investor not to be discriminated within the countries that they operate in, but also to protect what is known as, you know, among other things, the legitimate expectations of the foreign investor when they go to the country. So the way that international investment treaties are designed now is that they tend to privilege the foreign investor within the countries, that what we call the host countries, mostly developing countries, because if you look at, you know, where the investors' home states are, they tend to be from the Western industrial, like the former colonial powers, now no longer having colonial access to the resources, but they needed a way to enter the country legally. So what they do is they then sign these pretty much asymmetrical trade and investment relations, so the law facilitates their access too, rather than, you know, the colonial, overt colonial aspects. So they do, I think investment law is pretty much an, you know, a framework, but also international institutions. Tony mentioned the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank and the IMF, and pre this proliferation of investment treaties, which has basically only happened in the last 20, 25 years, right? You had the groundwork being set by the Bretton Woods institutions, who, by virtue of being what we call the lender of last resort in terms of financing, right? That when countries cannot fund activities for whatever reason, a lot of it also has to do with unequal international economic law structures, for example, unequal terms of trade from trade agreements, etc., and you know, structural problems within the economy, commodity dependence, etc., which is, you know, primarily due to the historical nature of the economy, but also you know, contemporary structures of trade which countries couldn't break out of. And as a consequence, reliance on financing from these international institutions also come with, you know, conditionalities and conditions of lending. And so a lot, most of you will be familiar Germany with the Greek debt crisis, which also comes with a lot of conditions, right? So it's a similar thing in terms of developing countries. And they laid a lot of the groundwork, as in before there were trade and investment treaties, actually the World Bank and IMF conditionalities had already liberalized these markets through what is known as unilateral liberalization. There were conditions of loans and financing from these institutions that opened up markets within developing countries to foreigners, and also instituted through significant legal reform in economic sectors such as mining and agriculture, land reform, all these, so facilitated the legal reform of those countries' domestic economies prior to entry into this. So some the groundwork was already laid, and then the international law came in, then international economic law came in, once those economies were already restructured internally through the advice, and this is the law and development movement that was talked about. I think Louise and I come from a tradition that we hope is the more critical law and development movement, but there is, you know, the original law and development movement was this movement at the World Bank, initiated by the World Bank to institute a lot of these legal reforms within countries to facilitate this kind of extraction, natural resource extraction, access to markets. And we are actually seeing right now the new contemporary wave of that in a different form through the guise of meeting the Sustainable Development Goals. So right now, there is a massive push at the international level to what I call privatized aid or privatized development, because the Sustainable Development Goals is used as a conduit for some donor countries, a lot of companies to say, well, we've got a very ambitious agenda to meet these development goals within developing countries. We haven't got enough money to meet all our commitments to reduce maternal mortality, you know, combat health epidemics, combat climate change, etc. We're going to need a lot more money. So the only way that we're going to need more money because of the austerity in the north is to encourage private companies to come in and give that money. And we're seeing this new wave of facilitating access by companies into developing countries through another guise, right? So we have different inroads, which I think is very, very problematic for developing countries. And you know, it facilitates this kinds of, it continues that colonial relationship. But I think one of the myths, right, that is perpetuated through, and I said, you know, law is also a myth, but it depends on myths as well. It depends on some narratives and symbols of certain ideas of what we have. And one of this is great conceptualization of it by Daniel Tarullo, who's a professor at Georgetown University right now, but he was a former member of the Federal Reserve Bank, right, during the Obama administration. Now, in a 1985 article, pre his policy time, Daniel Tarullo talks about this thing called the myth of normalcy, right, which is applied to developing countries. It's the adolescent myth that fuels this kind of civilizing mission that we talk about, the Twales scholars talk about, that developing countries are seen as somehow not equal sovereigns in the international economic order because they're not so economically developed. So it's kind of like, you know, they're not normal. The normal conception of order is, you know, like Germany or the UK or some Western economy that's based on some sort of embedded liberalism as well in some ways, right? It's not like, you know, that's the structure of society. And what you have is this legitimation of international institutions, including development institutions, including international financial institutions, to intervene in countries. So we heard a lot about the interventions for humanitarian reasons and human rights reasons that's justified on the basis of this kind of like, you know, difference between the developing and developed world. But I think this myth of normalcy, the need to, that there is a normal state of affairs and economic order, and it's very Eurocentric. And developing countries who don't, because you don't stack up to that, countries in debt distress, for example, they're not normal. They're, you know, there's a crisis. So that means that the international community has a right to intervene, and it has a right to tell these countries what to do. I mean, I come from a country that rejected the IMF in the Asian financial crisis. And I think we were much better for it, right? I mean, if you looked at how my country did, in Malaysia did, in comparison to the countries in the region in the post-Asian financial crisis, I mean, it was very much, very clear, you know, how we could have that policy space that you talked about that was increasingly used. But we were lucky because, you know, we could do it. We were able to. And I think this myth of normalcy allows the international community to go in. The SDGs, for example, allow for that discourse to be used to enter into countries to say, well, actually, we know what, you know, it's good for you. It allows the IMF to say, you are not here. You want to get from here to here. Let's forget about our contributions to your debt crisis that, you know, like we precipitated this issue through asymmetrical relations, through the financialization, through the unregulated global markets, financial markets, but that's fine. You are now in crisis and we have to help you and you need our help, so we're going to intervene. And that's legitimated by the international community, right? Mm-hmm. And that is a problem.
Okay. So I think that's an important point also to point out that there might be more scope to resistance than is sometimes acknowledged, that you might refute aid by the international financial institutions, or maybe that you could also cancel your bilateral investment treaties, as many countries have been doing in recent times. But maybe sticking for a while to the critique of particularly international investment law and the international financial institutions, given all the disenchantment with these regimes of international law, often a remedy called for is to strengthen human rights. So, because what is often observed, and I think rightly so, is the asymmetry in enforcement mechanisms. You have a very strong enforcement mechanism, for example, in the WTO, but even a stronger one instituted by international investment law, where investors get the procedural right to bring claims directly against states. So the question arises, indeed, would things be helped if human rights were integrated into international investment treaties, if they were mainstreamed even better into the international financial institutions? So this brings me now to you, Obi, because you're not only a specialist in human rights, but you're also pointing out in your work the hegemonic dimensions of international human rights law and practice. So I'd like you to expand for us on this a bit.
Thank you so much. I think that those who have come before me, especially Macau in particular, have said a lot of other stuff about human rights, but I think they bear repetition, if that's what you find that I'm doing. I think that one of the most fundamental things to keep in mind when we look at human rights, and one of, you know, not just Twill, but also sort of other critical internationalists, lawyers, their contributions have been to show, sometimes in granular fashion, sometimes through more general theory, the ways in which human rights, including international human rights, can serve, and indeed have always served, both progressive goals on the one hand and hegemonic or other regressive goals on the other hand, and sometimes in tandem, actually, making it much more difficult to unravel, right? So, for example, a critique of the International Criminal Court often leads you to stares. How can you criticize such a good thing, right? Because there's some progressive goals going on, there are progressive things going on that almost begin to mask the hegemonic things that go on at the same time. So even if sometimes they're not in tandem, sometimes they're sequential, sometimes they're not. This is not necessarily original to me, although my work has contributed. Makar himself has made this point. Upendra Bakshi's work is noted in his book, The Future of Human Rights, in this respect. The invocation of human rights can ground or justify both insurrection, progressive insurrection, as well as a politics of domination. So when human rights are invoked, it's not always for a good end. Just because you invoke human rights does not mean that your objective is good. And that's often the mistake that is often made in the literature and even by well-meaning activists, right? Take the way in which the alt-right, the KKK, I like to call them, invoke freedom of speech a lot in the US. Neo-Nazis in Europe have always, or freedom of assembly, as if it's this neutral thing that protects all kinds, all shades of politics, all shades of action, and all that. But this freedom of assembly and freedom of speech also protects activists who work against dictators and draconian regimes all over the world, the Arab Spring and so on, right? So it is the same, Bakshi calls it separate and unequal shelter. Right, so it shelters this politics of domination at the same time as it shelters progressive politics. But it's a separate, an unequal kind of sheltering that goes on. And so this is basic, is fundamental to understanding the Twill approach. If you start from that basis, if you start from sort of this premise, then you open up, as Macau has sort of shown here, you open up human rights, your human rights vision to all kinds of realizations. And then if you take that, parlay that sort of on the global scale, you begin to see that just because human rights, and in particular, to some extent, women's rights, for instance, was invoked as justification, as grounding for the invasion of Afghanistan, does not mean that that's why the US went to Afghanistan, right? It sounds basic to some, but when you look at the actual living human rights law, I'm interested in living human rights law, not human rights text, the way in which it's represented on paper. But if you look at how human rights is actually performed, dramatized, represented, and acted, you will see that most people take that for granted, not most people, but many people, too many people, take it for granted that these invocations are made with sort of progressive goals in mind. For democratization, for example, on the African continent, which most people would agree with. But oftentimes, the democratization agenda, again, masks a hegemonic economic and political agenda as well, right? And so what Twill work often does is try to, unpack in granular way to trace and follow and also show how these things have been continuous, right, over the long run. In many cases, in far too many cases, from colonialism to the present, albeit in different ways in detail, right? So on the general level, you actually find that the techniques, the structures, and all that have not morphed or changed all that much. And so you could be studying, Britain was doing in Nigeria in 1920s, and you could be studying what the IMF was doing. It was doing in the 70s and 80s, and the structure, the general structure, is amazingly similar. Of course, the details, the particular ways in which colonialism plays out or neocolonialism plays out, is of course different. And part of what I my sort of research agenda now, because I kind of wear two hats, both as an academic and as someone who's involved in UN work, is to almost be a participant observer to the more granular ways in which domination plays out. So those are just two examples. And this leads me to speak about, and this is of course a point that Tony Yangi has made at length in his book, how our assertions of our common humanity, which often grounds human rights, right? We are all humans, and therefore, if we're all humans, we're entitled to these rights, and we're entitled to then have our rights protected or advanced by people across the world on other continents and so on, how historically from colonial times, that's the very justification for empire. This is the structure of the argumentation, right? And that's why we must be suspicious of invocations of human rights, not because they are always bad or have bad objectives, but because they can have bad objectives. And that's why suspicion is a better stance or posture to have until the contrary is proven. Now, just sort of switching a little, even going back to the very fact that the human rights language is now the sole approved language of resistance or protest can be problematic, can exact transaction costs in the global south, at least in many parts of the global south. Rajagopal Balakrishnan's work shows this to an extent. It subordinates and displaces other languages of protest. So there's an erasure that happens there. It's as if before human rights came, people in the global south never thought about how to protect their dignity, how to protest against domination. They had no language with which to express it, right? So even bringing human rights uncritically, the human rights language uncritically, without realizing that, in fact, you are going to displace thinking that has gone on for thousands of years in many cases, it can be problematic. And actually exact transaction cost to an activist's, the activist project of defending the poor and the disenfranchised. Because take, for example, the language of duties, and here I take Macau's work on duties, right, which I think is absolutely brilliant, which is spoken very widely in around the African continent. Duties to young children, duties to aged parents. These say similar things as the human rights of, you know, elders' rights or children not to be abused and things like that. But an activist who go to a village or people who've never heard about the UDH and they start telling them about the UDH, what you're doing is adding transaction costs, delaying, perhaps Macau thinks indefinitely almost, the ability to root human rights in the consciousness of the people. If you just told them about duties, they will understand what you're saying. Why speak to them in a language they don't understand, except that you want to perform this erasure of local agency, normalization of the denial of the agency of people, the notion that thinking can go on in these places, or that has gone on in these places before human rights language came from elsewhere. Another point that Twill human rights scholars often make is to show in detail the way in which global power, and I think power is essential to really to understanding the career of human rights, the way that it circulates, the way that it shapes, and the way that it disciplines, right? Without power being brought in, it's almost impossible to explain it adequately. So we try to show the way in which global power shapes, inflects, deflects our understandings of when human rights has been violated, who the violated are, and who the violators are. One of the most powerful illustrations of this is with land reform in Southern Africa. I'm not from Southern Africa, but that for me, it's very powerful. The way in which the living human rights law and living human rights discourse characterizes, say, take the most popular example of Zimbabwe, right? All you hear is about the dispossession of white landowners in Zimbabwe. Almost nobody talks about the dispossession that led to the dispossession, right? And any attempt to remedy the dispossession that led to this dispossession is dead on arrival. It's necessarily anti-human rights. It's problematic because there's this kind of manna from heaven that fell and conferred property rights on colonialists, right? And for me, that's very deeply problematic and shows you the way in which human rights, not necessarily as text, but the way in which it's actually dramatized and performed and acted upon, has this almost innate bias. And I'm not talking about human rights as concept. I'm thinking about human rights as reality, the living human rights. And I'm taking time. But lastly, before I turn it over again to the moderator, another sort of argumentative move or maneuver that Twill human rights scholars often make is to show how the actual living expression of human rights or international, the living international human rights law is riven with hypocrisy. It's characterized by hypocrisy. So for example, before our very eyes in the last 2-3 years, we have a massive refugee crisis, right? But the crisis is not actually because there's a crisis of suffering in the third world. The crisis is because of a projected suffering or perhaps reduction in standard of living if all these people enter Europe. That's the characterization of the crisis. The crisis is as if there was no crisis until people started crossing the Mediterranean, right? That's the way in which the discourse proceeds. And the human rights of these migrants somehow is not accounted for. Somehow does not score on the register, right, of human rights. It does not soften European sovereignty. But can you take away migration, put a third world country, and put democracy, right? Imagine making an argument that because of the sovereignty of Cote d'Ivoire, that they are not subject to respecting human rights, right? But when it comes to migration, sovereignty hardens. This is the same sovereignty that, until recently, we were told was so over, was passé, right? State sovereignty is now malleable, it doesn't really exist, but once European interests get challenged, or perceptions of European interests, all of a sudden, sovereignty reappears in the hardest possible form, right? And all that. So these are the kinds of, I just want to, you know, give you garden variety, so to speak, of the kinds of arguments that Twill human rights scholars make. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, your mentioning of the so-called refugee crisis reminds me of Susan Marks and her call on us international lawyers to maybe look at how international law plays a part in planned misery instead of talking like our German politicians now do about root causes, which we might tackle through development aid, which then might prevent refugees from coming to Europe. So Louis and Obi already talked a bit about we have to look at the reality of international law. So for years now you have been insisting that we have to look at the operations of international law in the everyday, especially in the post-colony, if we want to learn something about international law. So what do we learn, maybe in particular about international economic law, if we look at its operations in the everyday?
Thanks, Isabel. Thanks, organizers, for having us all here. I imagine that many of the members of the public that for the first time heard this rubric or third world approaches to international law are all thinking that we're all mad. But just let me tell you that when we have private meetings, we have lots of fun. The conversation never stops. And I just want to continue on that line that the conversation never stops. And I'm going to try to take you somewhere else with it. So as you all have witnessed over the course of the afternoon, critical international lawyers, in particular those of us that try to, many of us come or try to think constantly about the global south, the south generally, we're really constantly and in a upset and angry about what international law did in the past and what it continues to do today. Normally when that critique is put on the table, we, by fault, but we normally try to explain it, and our audience, you this afternoon, tend to think that when international law does something, it does it in the ways in which normally international law is imagined to do things. So when we mention international law, you immediately have images of what international law is. So immediately you think about the UN, or the World Bank, or the International Monetary Fund, or you think about an international court, the International Criminal Court, or the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, or you think about human rights, yeah? And in particular, you think about those gross violations of human rights. International law exists there, or it should exist there. So we immediately want to, we make this link between our spaces of international law and this thing. And as you reflect about that idea or that aesthetics that accompanies international law, you immediately will think, come to the realization that international law normally is thought as this language, this body of norms and institutions that are extremely powerful, but they only exist in very small spaces, okay? And in my work over the course of several years, I've been trying to say that is correct. International law exists in the IMF, in the World Bank, in the UN, in the General Assembly. It exists or should exist when we talk about or think or try to fight against gross violations of human rights. But also international law exists everywhere. And exists everywhere for the very same reasons that Macau, Tony, Obi, Celine have been mentioning, because international law has a structure, the world in which we live in, all the way through, all the way through. There are many ways to get to that, prove that claim, but just only think about the very little spaces that exist today in the planet that are not regulated by national states, okay? So we are around 8 billion people, and we, all these 8 billion human beings, are being regulated in one way or another by national states. A very few number of those states were original states. Germany, the first of them. When you think about the Treaty of Westphalia that Tony was making today, the forms were originated here, but that claim expanded throughout the world. And the national state form became to be the dominant political administrative unit that ended up regulating life across the planet. Now, if you take that as your starting point to think about international law, that international law is about small spaces, but international law is somehow everywhere, you have to, yes, once again, think about those smaller spaces where international law continue to exist, but then you need to change at least your modality of thinking about international law, what it does in three levels. You need to change the scale. You need to change the position in which you think about international law, and you need to think about the intensity of the dramas that are unfolded by international law. Okay, so in terms of a scale, we should get down from up above in the sky in the General Assembly of the United Nations, and then you go at the ground level. In terms of position, you should not just always think about international law in those cases where there are gross violations of human rights. You need to try to think about all of those micro dramas that ended up marking the life of pretty much all the global south, you will say, but also increasingly the people of the global north. And similarly, you need to change intensity. You shouldn't just get upset, or we shouldn't get only upset, when there's blood. A colleague of all of us, Rob Knox, says that when we think about human rights, we think about two types of hands both of them black. Either they are black hands up above asking for money, or they are black hands waving, saying, yes, we got human rights. Okay? We need to change the intensity. We need to think about other ways in which international law continues to do a huge amount of work in a bad way at different intensity. So with that as a preliminary note, I would like to take you somewhere else. So, and it's a very quick reflection about a work that I've been doing recently, and I think that will help us to give a little bit of a much more kind of tactile sense of the kind of intervention that we're trying to do in TWEL today, is particularly when we think about kind of the broader operation and effects of international law. So in my most recent work, I've been trying to think about this discourse called the security and development discourse. After the September 11th, the question of security entered very strongly into the developmental agenda. And the World Bank started to say, if we want development in the Global South, we need to promote security, okay? And many countries, as you can imagine, in the Global South have been forced to take up that agenda. So the country that I've been trying to understand how it has responded to it has been Colombia, where I'm originally coming from, And not simply just Colombia, but it's a big city, a 4 million people city in the southwest part of Colombia, and the name of the city is Cali. Maybe some of you know, because it's the world capital of salsa. It's a fantastic city, hot, extremely diverse, quite progressive. And this city, like many other cities in the Global South, is trying to do the best that it can to globalize, yeah? It is a city that is part of a country that has gone through several rounds of structural adjustment that started when Colombia was set up as a national state and continue today through forms of intervention orchestrated by everyone, the World Bank, the IMF, and the private financial system. And so this city is trying to do the best what it can, but it has a problem. It's one of the most violent cities in the world, it's in the top of the 50 most violent cities in the world. And most of the crime committed in the city, not surprisingly, is committed by black Colombians, black African Colombians. So the city in now late liberal times is trying to respond in the way that it is in the best possible way, you know, through developmental interventions. And what it's doing is setting up these really interesting experimental frameworks to bring these black kids into the official life of the city. And I hope everyone is following me, okay? So, and the idea is that if these kids enter into the official life of the city, the security and development nexus will be a virtuous one, okay? City gets more secure, kids get developed, we are all win-win, and then we're going forward, the idea is, we're going all forward really strongly into the realm of globalization, and Cali will be a developed city, contributing to the development of Colombia and contributing to the development of the world. Now, the problem is, before that, I was going to say something, and then I will say the problem. So, when you look at the programs that the city has been implemented, those programs has two phases. On the one hand, some of the money that the city has been using to attack crime in the city has been putting money into modernizing the police force. The other, and you can imagine what kind of intervention is that, security cameras, so on and so forth. The other part of that intervention has been spending money on development programs targeted to these kids. And those programs, those development programs for the kids, have themselves two phases. On the one hand, those programs are, in a very revolutionary way, are trying to offer some jobs to these kids to enter into the official life of the city by doing kind of mega environmental work or helping in the running of the public transport system of the city. On the other hand, yeah, so it's work, great. It's kind of the return to pre-neoliberal times, fantastic. On the other hand, the city is doing something that has been used for a long time in the Global South, that is psychosocial intervention to these kids, trying to teach them that the problem of them being violent is because they're coming from families that are distracted, they don't have a very good solid value system, so on and so forth. Now, the problem of this story that I'm telling you here about is that even though Cali is a progressive city, even though it doesn't want to do the kind of Philippines Duterte technique of killing the kids, even though it's really trying the best that they can do with human rights, even though it's trying to behave the best it can with the multilateral bank and with the international public bank, the city doesn't have enough money, okay? So the city offers some jobs, lots of psychosocial therapeutic treatment to these kids, but the queue is too long. The queue is always too long. Some of those kids manage to get the jobs, but the large majority of them, they never get there. I'm interested in my work with that kind of drama. How we deal with that, how we deal with the broken hopes of those kids that never, ever, whatever we do, are gonna get in. That is the drama of the Global South. That is the drama of the Global South. Wherever you go, the queue gets longer, the promise gets bigger. Countries in the Global South try to behave well, they want to behave well, it doesn't get there. I think when we think that in my own work, when I think about the everyday operation of international law, that's what I kind of spaces that I want to take my readers, and it's a great opportunity that I was able to take you there.
Thank you. Celine, you wanted to come in, or that's too long ago now?
I wanted to have a quick, because I just thought of it when Obi was talking about human rights and the problems of human rights, and I just wanted to link that with international economic law and the problematic nature of the construction of legal norms under international economic law. So I wanted to bring up this idea of business and human rights. Okay, so in the last few years, there's been a resurgent interest in this concept of business and human rights, you know, making business attend to these human rights, complicit, accountable, obliged, you know, placing obligations on businesses for human rights compliance, right? So there's this whole thing about socially responsible investments and then bringing human rights, holding multinational companies to account for how they treat people in their operation, right? And then while you have this kind of, so that's a parallel process that's going on in the human rights regime, okay? And then on the other side, you have these, what I've spoken about earlier, these international investment treaties that also happen in parallel, right? And the notion of international investment law is based on this notion that the state must be held to account for the promises that the state makes. So this is one of the fundamental, when I talked about myths earlier, this is one of the fundamental myths that is, you know, constantly being peddled and reinforced, that you have to, you know, like Louis said, you have to be a good state, you have to be a good citizen. And if you're a good citizen, you have to respect contracts. When you make a promise to somebody, you have to respect that. And so that's where the underlying, this is very, very simplifying the notion of legitimate expectations under international investment law, but effectively that's it. You know, when you make a promise to a foreign investor, you really should, and they come into your country and they invest, then you have to uphold that promise, right? That's a promise to the investor, the state makes to the foreign investor. But then there's this other aspect of, like, what about the promises that the state has made to its own citizens, right? In terms of environmental protection, in terms of universal health care, access to land, promises to indigenous peoples that it would protect their livelihoods and access to land within a certain area, right? And so this is where I think the human rights dimension comes in, because you have this parallel process of trying to make, you know, businesses more socially responsible, adding the human rights dimension, saying, okay, you have to consider the human rights of communities within. But then actually the problem isn't that. That was a parallel system that was started up in terms of trying to rehabilitate the problems that were starting with international investment law, which has this notion that the foreign investor has primacy over everybody else. And it's the same when you look at debt crisis, right? So when you say things like, you know, in an austerity, say, oh, we don't have money to pay pensions of our pensioners, because we owe this money to, because, you know, we have to be a good citizen, because otherwise Moody's and all these rating agencies will downgrade us, right? So we have to pay our debts, because it's contract and commitment, this narrative of contract and commitment. I explore that in one of my papers in 2014. I talk about this, like, you know, this narrative of contract and commitment is very, very strong. So you have to meet your obligations to your financiers. But then what about the pensioners, who in most cases, it's not free money. You know, people pay into the system their entire lives. When there's a debt crisis, how come the promises that a state makes to its creditors and its contract trumps everything else that the state has made? So there is, like Macau was saying earlier, I really like this, we have no better language in politics and law to talk about a better tomorrow. And I think that's the problem, you know, with international economic law, somehow you cannot integrate it. That's why human rights then becomes a conduit and a substitute for our inability within international economic law to think about alternatives to the sort of norms and principles that we enforce through international economic agreements.
Yeah, and maybe one may add that it's not just that international economic law calls on states to keep their promises and value their contracts, but that somehow law has a tendency of becoming more binding in the periphery than at the center, and that it's more easily broken at the center without repercussions. You wanted to add something.
Just add quickly that I agree, of course, and it's to point out, I mean, this is one of the key points that Bakshi, of course, makes, in his work, the way in which, although human rights is then sort of posited and offered as the intervention, the thing to ameliorate what international economic law is doing, but human rights itself is already constrained, yeah, right, in almost internally by the same economic logic, yeah, right? So that, I mean, he has this thing of the trade-related, market-friendly human rights, and the good state now is increasingly being viewed as the state that is friendly to foreign capital, right? That is the good state. That's the progressive third world state, or any other state. But as has just been pointed out, the impact is disproportionate to third world countries, again, because of power. We have to, that power asymmetries are key to the analytic here. And so the progressive third world state, because progressivism is measured not as much by your breaking promises, although that's there too, to your own citizens, but much more fundamentally and much more impactfully by breaking promises to foreign investors and the IMF and the World Bank. That's what gets you in real deep trouble.
And it's
you
also
can get along by breaking promises, human rights promises to your people, but the moment you break it to the IMF, you're dead.
But it's also about the enforcement mechanisms, which I think Isabel mentioned earlier, about the fact that, you know, when in international economic agreements, the dispute settlement, the enforcement mechanisms of a state's obligations under international law are much more forceful than the sanctions or in terms of international human rights law. And that is not by accident that mm-hmm. that has happened, mm-hmm. right?
So I just want to, a couple of points, one current and one historical. So the current one, I don't know if anyone here or some of the people in the public have come across with the most recent book by James Ferguson, a very well-known anthropologist, who at some point wrote The Anti-Politics Machine, kind of a critical history of development. And in this recent book, Give Man a Fish, he tries to understand cash transfers, minimal income, experiments in South Africa and Namibia. Fantastic book. He's trying to kind of understand what is the positive impact of that and what is kind of the sociality that is coming from those exercises. But he starts with the book with a very chilling fact. In an interview with someone from the stock exchange in South Africa, the person working there said mentioned to him that that if 20%, 30% of the black population, unemployed black population of South Africa disappears like this, the market wouldn't even respond to it, because there's surplus population that is never, ever gonna be integrated.
Okay.
Never gonna be integrated in the system. The system is not gonna be able, the system was not able to do it, the system is not gonna be able to do it. The McKinsey think tank, if you want, to believe on them, they say that in the next few years, in particular from now till 2030, 800 million jobs are gonna be disappearing, okay? So the little jobs that they were in the South, they're gonna increasingly be less and less and less, because what the only new jobs that are gonna be created are in the service industries, where I normally tend to be concentrated in the global North or in the sections of the North of the global South. So then the question is how do you industrialize, how do you modernize the economies in the global South? Because that's how the link to sovereignty, the link to exercise sovereignty is always have been, yeah, this is clear for everyone apart from international lawyers, is always have been linked with economic power. This is the secret behind the machine of Germany, for example, okay? So you need to have an industrial base that is able not only to give you cash, but also able to give jobs to the people, which you then legitimize yourself. If you don't give jobs, it's gone. Is gone. That's why all the states in the global South have been gone for a long time. Now, and here's my historical point. I recently concluded in collaboration with many of the people that have been speaking today and some people in the public, a large publication on the Bandung Conference. So for us dwellers, the Bandung Conference is a wonderful, wonderful moment. So it's a conference that took place in Bandung, in Indonesia, in 1955. And it was the first ever international conference organized by non-white people, okay? And that was remarkable. It required a huge amount of political organization and activism for many people across the world for that to happen. Countries from Asia and Africa come together for the first time in history to decide the future. I learned two things from that. So the first one was that they wanted to present themselves exactly as Celine and I was mentioning before. They were good subjects, and they were even better subjects than the European national states. Like Rose Parfait put it in her chapter, they were newer and truer subjects of international law. Mad countries, crazy countries in Europe and the United States, were engaged in a silly war called the nuclear war. And they were engaged in this thing called the Cold War. Countries in the global South were trying to organize themselves and say, we need to be better. Second thing that I learned, they really try to, and this is maybe was the problem, they swallow the pill of development. They say, we need to industrialize ourselves, because that's the way that we're gonna make real the sovereign promise. The problem was that by 1955, the terms and conditions of international economic law have been already set. So there was, after the Second World War, there was several institutions came out of the political arrangements at that time. The UN, the IMF, and the World Bank, and there had to be an organization for international trade. That organization was gonna be decided, or was decided, in La Habana. Okay, in 1947. However, in 1946, rich countries in the world, the global North countries, the European countries, in association with Australia, they wanted to arrive to Havana with a preset list of rules to be on the same page and not let third world countries to discuss this nitty-gritty where really things matter in economic terms. In 1947, Global North and Global South countries arrived to Havana. Those agreements were already in place, so they say, let's get onto establishing an institution, and when that institution is there, we can maybe go and revisit those pre-agreements that we had established in 1946 in Geneva. Okay, we're going to have an institution. We're going to have discussions. It can behave and take political decisions like in the General Assembly. However, that institution that was going to be in charge of trade, that made the promise of regulate the international economic system, never came into being because the US Senate blocked it. So what we ended up was with these preset rules of trade that have been already set before countries got into Havana. You can take it from there, and that's what has come today. The impossibility, the true impossibility of countries in the global south to industrialize or to modernize their economies. Voila.
Okay. Somehow I wanted to use Bandung and your fascinating book published with Vasuki Nizia and Michael Fakri as the transition to the part on utopian aspirations, and now you destroyed it by telling this depressing story. But still, in the introduction, you describe the significance of Bandung for international lawyers, lying in the fact that it was an act of collective imagination, a practical political project giving rise to institutional experiments and social movements. So I want all of you now to think, are there projects, moments in the course of decolonization which we could connect to reestablish faith in international law? Maybe Bandung was one such moment, the new international economic order might be such a project, and maybe Obi, from your work now as UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and International Solidarity, in a way, could that be considered a continuation of projects of self-determination which bore some potential, or was the door always already foreclosed, and is it now, and are we all in the third world now? But that's another question I would like to discuss more intensely if we had time, because I don't think this is necessarily a good way to put it, but
okay.
So,
you're the king of Bandung.
So let me start with Bandung and qualify what I just said. I mean, I let the punchline go too early. but so I'm going to bring a kind of a theoretical apparatus here to try to engage with Bandung. So a wonderful postcolonial theorist, that wrote a book called Provincialized in Europe a few years ago. He says, how we understand the history of the world, okay, how we engage with this animal is called the history of the world. And then he said, it's a very big topic, and it's complicated, and it's full of replete with Eurocentric views and narratives and mythologies. He said, what one thing to start kind of dissecting this animal or getting there is to always to keep in mind kind of the Marxist premise, then there are multiple histories, okay? And then he said, there are at least two histories. There's history one, and then it's history two, okay? And history one, say, is mainstream history. And it's a history that installed in such a way that enables processes of accumulation and exploitation. But it's always, there's a history two, and history three, and four, and five, and six. But there at least is a history two, of histories of resistance and tenacity and fight and care and love and friendship. And that those two run always in parallel, okay? And I think Bandung, elements of Bandung itself, Bandung is not necessarily history too all around, but elements of Bandung, the energy that went into it, the energy that came out of it, progressive energy that came out of it, is definitely belongs to history too. And that has been the history of international law all across, a dance between history one and history two, okay? So every time there has been a, and this is why we still believe some, I mean, I don't say believe, but it's still working international law. It's not necessarily because we believe that there's an international law history too, that it's gonna be perfect, we're rather beautiful. No, we believe, we are engaged with it because if you don't engage with it, that history too disappears, gets more ephemeral, okay? So once again, Bandung is interesting because it teaches us, it shows us that the fight is important. Bamcho Obi, you are engaged on an ongoing Bandung effort to try and reformulate the terms of and conditions of this, no?
Perhaps by, I don't know, maybe some of you might disagree, perhaps by nature I'm an optimist. I know I don't sound like that. So this is where sometimes I differ with some of my colleagues, who accuse me of being too optimistic, right? It's almost like I have this hope that doesn't come out of my analysis and all that. But indeed, it does come out of my analysis as a wonderful segue, Luis. As Luis just pointed out, I think that, Bandung obviously didn't achieve what it set out to achieve. But that's less the important thing than that, as you said, that it showed the value of trying, of fighting. And it's not as if the world in 1955 is exactly the world today. I mean, Malaysia resisted successfully. So you can map, you can put on a ledger, all the unsuccessful, incidents, shall we say, or iterations of resistance, and the successful ones. And, you would have things in this column, right? The successful ones. So, till this day, Nigeria is a much weakened power than it was, say, in 1980 even, but it's still resisting the EU trade pact, I forget the former name, till today, and I'm surprised, actually, that almost every other African country has signed, and is still resisting it, right? So, and Nigeria is not a particularly governed by a particularly radical or even whatever elite, right? At this moment, so there are possibilities there, right? I think that it's important. I don't know if I'm answering a question that wasn't asked, but it's important, as Isabel sort of hinted in her message to us, to talk, to think about the way in which we can reimagine action, right? Resistance. Okay. So, critical elements, for example, in my view, critical elements in the global north are, not to put too much of a stress on it, critical, key to one dimension, that they're key to moving the needle in a progressive way. Why do I say this, right? Canada, last year or 2 years ago, did not just wake up one morning and accept 20,000 Syrians overnight, right? I mean, there's been decades of action, by Canadian refugee activists that prepared first the party that took over power just before that, and the prime minister himself, when he wasn't even a member of parliament, in order to be in that mental, to have that mentality that allowed him to take that. Something that even in Canada was still a political risk. We still do have our own Trumpites. Canada is not some El Dorado. You have people on the right wing who don't want refugees to be taken and all that. So I think that kind of internal softening, if you like, of the global north countries, it's important in order to become, for them to become more receptive to resistance and protest and protestation from the global south, right? So you need those kinds of alliances. Now, I'm not one of the complaints of global critical Twill scholars is that such alliances are very quickly taken over by global north because of asymmetries of resources and all that, right? And global south activists, you know, always writing grants to fit a narrow Ford Foundation sort of model because they want the money and they're doing the rational thing, right? But you can see possibilities. Now, how that plays out in actual practice remains to be seen. And I think that, for want of a better way of putting it, we need to emplace in the places where these decisions are taken, and these are not just at the civil society level, but also, in my view, scaling up even to the UN level, right? Now, of course, we need to do so being extremely conscious, even suspicious, of the inherent limits of such action. So if you were to go to the UN, and you thought that you could arrive the UN, and because you're so great, there'll be action, you know, the next 5 years on something, God help you. First get your refund, right, of your travel cost, in good time, right? So, you know, I'm not speaking in my UN capacity here, but what I'm trying to say is that the UN moves in, you know, small paces, in increments, and there are things you can do, and there are things you can't do, right? And we need to carefully map those. What can you do, what you can do? But what I mean by emplacement is I would rather Louis were in place in certain committees than some other people, even from Colombia. You understand my point? The third world is not this place where everybody thinks like Louis or Macau or Tony Angi or Celine, you know, anybody, right? There is a diversity of perspective, right? And there are, it was Chimney, B.S. Chimney, that talks about the transnational capitalist class. Some of them are from the global south, right? So not everybody thinks the same way. So I would rather, Celine was in certain committees, and I have seen, I can't, of course, disclose certain confidences, the difference it makes to have not even twelers, but just critical other critical international lawyers on some of these committees, UN bodies that I've sat, and it makes a lot of difference. Let me leave it at that for now.
Maybe just to clarify, I was not just thinking about how to reimagine resistance, but also how to reimagine institutions and whether there is actually scope today for some, at least, institutional experimentation, and if there is, which institutions should we experiment with to bring about a maybe more just global economic order. But of course, resistance maybe comes first, so we get this scope.
So I think in terms of, the current institutions, and I don't want to talk about the new international economic order so much, but it was one of those moments that the developing countries, you know, felt that the political sovereignty did not bring the independence, and that you needed an economic sovereignty as well in order to, you know, achieve that full sovereignty. Of course, that was before they encountered Twill scholars, right, who upended the whole notion of sovereignty in the first place. So I don't want to focus on that. What I wanted to do, actually, I was thinking about this. It's about the representations, and I want to talk about the everyday resistance. I think Albie really hit it on the head in the UN, you know, and all these institutions. And we forget, we always see the big fights, right? You know, like the Bandungs and, you know, like, the G77's, you know, articulations in these places. But actually, what is the fight is happening every day in these international organizations. You know, diplomats and representatives from the South, from the Third World, fight these fights every single day. I call them the square bracket fights because that was my first entry into, yes, Obi is laughing, right? For those of you who know the UN system, you. But it's the square bracket fight, right? It was my first introduction to the processes at the UN, right? Where, so developing countries would be in its negotiating room and, you know, there'd be all these Americans. And I was just struck. I remember the first time I went into one of these rooms, I was working for an NGO in the South, and there was this really impressive Indian representative from a mission, and she was really impressive, like not just in terms of all these state people in like black dark suits. She was this bright, vibrant lady with this, you know, sari, and she was really impressive. And it was fighting over square brackets, because as you know, like texts in the UN drafts are never negotiated. Those that are still in contention, you know, the wording of each document is put in square brackets, right? And these diplomats fight every day to put make sure that those are in square brackets, because we didn't agree to that, because that's what the you know, like the more dominant states will insist, oh yeah, we have already agreed in this wording. And it's always this fight about, you know, like, no, we haven't agreed yet because we don't agree with this, and it has to be in square brackets. And so I always call that the square bracket fight, and these are the things that diplomats are fighting and representatives are fighting, and we forget these. These are the moments, this is the everyday international law. It might not be in the post-colony, but it's the representatives of the post-colonies within these institutions that fight every single day, and I'm always really impressed by it. And apart from that, it's also the other aspect to it, and it's not just the elite fights, but also the resistance on the ground. So I'm talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, right, the TPP. Malaysia, you see, okay, actually, ultimately, we signed. So we're a nation state, and it said, oh, well, Malaysia is signed up to the TPP. But actually, there was a huge fight, you know, within the country, internal to the country. You know, there were politicians that were doing impact assessments. I think, you know, maybe I shouldn't say this too loudly, because, much better than the British government currently with the Brexit impact assessments. Shall I say that? I'm being filmed, so maybe I will have this on the Daily Mail, right? Like the my face there. But they did do that. They did, you know, NGOs collated. They did, the government, you know, like didn't spend a lot of time, but the NGOs, the civil society, they did an impact assessment of line by line. They themselves decided what are the red lines when you go into a negotiation, right? What is the impact? If we had this, what would be the impact on agriculture, on mining, on, you know, the sectors of the economy, the services? So those were the things that were that are happening. They're not just, you know, like, these are everyday resistance that happens in the South, right, to international institutions by representatives of the South. And I think my other thing that I want to say, and before I shut up, to rekindle a sense of possibility, somebody told me this, right, you know, like, you get so easily offended. This was something in relation to something else. You know, always take offense. And I said to myself, I thought about this, and then I then wrote this person an email afterward and said, no, I want to take offense. You know, I will always continue to take offense. It's because when we stop taking offense, when we lose the sense of indignation and indignance and indifference, this is when the resistance stops. Because everybody was offended at some point. You know, like the independence fight, I mean, Gandhi was offended. Right? Mandela was offended. Rosa Parks was offended. Martin Luther King was offended. And we have to take offense. And we have to continue taking offense. Whether I'm, because, you know, there's that black, some of you might have heard about this black tie charity philanthropic event that took place in London 2 days ago, that, you know, all these philanthropists, business people were groping the hostesses. It was a men-only event. So, why are you offended? You know, a woman, right? So I want to take offense. I want to take offense when somebody says, oh, you know, you can't be here because you're a woman. You can't be here because you're not white. You're a person of color. I want to take offense, because the moment we stop taking offense is when the moment that resistance stops.
Thank you, Celine. That was on the point. Now it's 5:15. We have to end our panel. I have to apologize for a bit of a mismanagement of time. I would have liked to give you the opportunity to ask questions, but we have to end because in 15 minutes there will be a very exciting artist's talk with Eason Heraclito. So please be back in 15 minutes, and until then, enjoy the break. And thank you very much to the panelists for being here and talking with us. Thank you.